In November 2013, the ABC's Q&A program hosted a panel as part of the Festival of Dangerous Ideas. And these things are always interesting, but I found the final question of the night the most interesting. This was the question: which so-called dangerous idea do each of you, the panelists, think would have the greatest potential to change the world for the better if it were implemented? Of course, you can see Germaine Greer on that panel. There was some other equally colourful characters there as well. But it was Peter Hitchens, not the antagonistic brother, but Peter Hitchens, the Christian, the British journalist, who said this: "The most dangerous idea in human history and philosophy remains the belief that Jesus Christ was the Son of God and rose from the dead, and that is the most dangerous idea you will ever encounter." The presenter, in a rare moment of graciousness, I think, toward a Christian, invited Peter Hitchens to actually say, "Look, you can't just leave it there. Can you explain what you mean by that?" And this was the follow-up to that. "Well," he says, "because it alters the whole of human behaviour and all our responsibilities. It turns the universe from a meaningless chaos into a designed place in which there is justice and there is hope. And therefore, we all have a duty to discover the nature of that justice and work towards that hope. It alters us all. If we reject it, it alters us all as well. It is incredibly dangerous. And it's why so many people turn against it." At this time of semester, you're probably quite focused on that last assignment. You're thinking, what's life going to be like when you finish that last exam? And perhaps for some of you, it's a little bit of stress, anxiety about that. What if the next couple of weeks don't go according to plan? And what are the implications of that? But I think as we think about what Peter Hitchens is saying, if he is right, then actually dedicating some time and continuing to join with fellow Christians, with others, to investigate the things of Christ may in fact be the most significant thing that you've done all semester. Today we're going to consider the resurrection. And we're going to see just how dangerous an idea it actually is. That it can actually alter the whole of human behaviour. As we come to Mark 16, though, I want to say maybe first of all something about how the gospel ends. And so I've included in your handout there in the passage, you can see a note right at the end after verse 8, which reads, "The earliest manuscripts and some other ancient witnesses do not have verses 9 to 20. If you've never kind of noticed that, you might be wondering, what does that mean? What's the significance of that? You might not be in the habit of reading footnotes either in the books that you're researching for your assignment or even in the Bible itself, but it's actually quite significant because in your reading of the Bible, you'll see that's where the translators put the little notes as they come across different variants in the plethora of manuscripts that we have from the New Testament. That's where they put their workings, so you can see where are they actually getting this from. Now, these variations usually can be explained by some kind of copying error, and they might have skipped or misspelt a word. None of those changes, those variants, make any difference whatsoever to the body of Christian teaching. It's just how scholars show the integrity of their work and transparency, so that, in fact, rather than casting doubt, it actually has the opposite effect. It fills us with great confidence that what we have in the Bible is actually a reliable reflection of what the original authors wrote. But here at the end of Mark 16, people have noticed that Mark appears to finish his gospel in a somewhat abrupt fashion, the end of verse 8. Later manuscripts, which versions like the King James Version is based on, had this additional ending of verses 9 to 20. So if you're looking in your Bibles, either electronic or paper, you'll see that this section is either in from verses 9 onwards, like kind of sometimes double square brackets, just to say, look, this is actually too big to actually fit in the footnote, I think is why they put it there. But actually, since versions like the King James Version were translated, then these older, more reliable manuscripts have been discovered, and they're the ones which don't have verses 9 to 20. And so I've put a picture up there of one of the most significant manuscripts there. Some people have suggested that there was an ending following on from verse 8, and that's a way of saying, well, verse 8's a bit abrupt, and saying maybe that's being lost to us. Maybe it's a bit like you've finished your assignment, you might have stapled it, but somewhere in between finishing it here at chaplaincy and running off to the assignment box, something's happened, a dog's eaten it, and you've missed that last page. I think that would show a bit of carelessness with the significance of the things that Mark is writing about. I'm not convinced that's actually a helpful way of thinking about it. I don't think that's actually what happened. But when you see the way the text is at the moment, the way God has preserved it for us, it sounds a bit abrupt, but it does actually make sense in its context. Most people nowadays, most scholars believe that Mark did in fact intend to finish his gospel in verse 8. And so what we have in Mark 16 is a relatively short passage. And yes, in some respects it feels a little abrupt, but it leaves us reflecting on the significance of the empty tomb and the response of the women as the first witnesses to it. So what is Mark 16? What is it here for? Well, I think the first thing that Mark wants us to see is to show us the reality of the resurrection. There's lots written about the evidence for the resurrection. There's lots of books. People write dissertations on it as well. And I can't go through all that material for you now. But there's two things I actually want us to see, in particular from this particular passage in Mark's gospel. The first is we see that the reality of the resurrection is through the eyewitness of the women. Mark lists three women in this group: Mary Magdalene, that is Mary from the town of Magdala, Mary the mother of James and Joseph, and you can see a footnote there in your handout as to a different spelling, as he's known as. And there's another woman there with them named Salome. The other gospel accounts suggest that there are other women involved in this process too, of either preparing the spices or seeing where the tomb is or arriving the next morning. But I think what Mark's doing here is the fact that he names these three women, he does it twice. That's why I've included a little bit of Mark 15 in your handout as well. I think that's Mark's way of actually saying, look, if you want to check these things out, these are the three people who were actually there, who saw these things. This is where I'm getting my information from. I think that's why that's one of the reasons why he's at pains to actually name these three women, and he does that twice, and names two of them again at the end of chapter 15. The women are eyewitnesses because that gives us confidence and trust in the resurrection. Now, the significance of that is, well, in the first century, women were not considered as credible witnesses. Now, the point is, far from being demeaning to these women, the fact that it's there in the scriptures and us being aware of what that cultural climate of the day actually was, it shows us the great honour, I think, which God bestows upon these women, that he's appointed these women to be the first eyewitnesses. You see, we haven't heard from the men since chapter 14, since Jesus' arrest. They've fled. Now, the women here, they flee too at the end after meeting the angel and hearing the angel's words. But God actually bestows great honour upon these women by entrusting to them this eyewitness account. Now, the significance of that is not just to value women, but actually to give us great confidence within that cultural climate that what Mark has recorded here is actually what took place. You see, if a certain group of people were not culturally considered reliable witnesses, then if you are fabricating a story, you don't rely upon them to persuade other people. You'd choose someone, you'd quote someone who's got a doctorate, someone who's written lots of books, someone who's got these credentials, not someone who, in the cultural sense, has no credentials. And so the fact that Mark records it here must be because that's actually what happened. And the testimony of the women centres on what they see at the tomb. When they go to the tomb, they see the tomb is empty, and they hear the explanation for that from an angel. The angel is, the word angel is not used, it's just in Mark's gospel, he describes it as a young man, but we're certainly interpreting it as a messenger from God to reveal to help make sense of what the women are seeing. You see, despite Jesus' repeated teaching throughout Mark's gospel about his imminent death and his subsequent resurrection, he's been doing that through chapters 8, 9 and 10, it seems that nobody really was expecting Jesus to physically rise from the dead that day. So you need to come up with an explanation for why the tomb is empty. Now, down through the ages, people have offered different explanations. Maybe the women went to the wrong tomb, which seems unlikely because in chapter 15, verse 47, they saw which tomb Jesus was laid in. Others suggest that Jesus recovered. Perhaps just the time in the coolness of the tomb was enough for him to recover. It doesn't explain how he then kind of rolls away, actually gets out of the tomb. So that doesn't seem very plausible either. Perhaps the oldest explanation, the one that we find even in Matthew's gospel, is that the disciples stole the body in order to make it look like Jesus had been raised, which seems unlikely given that the disciples didn't seem to be expecting Jesus to rise from the dead at the time. And through those, at least in those first couple of centuries, the reality of the empty tomb was never questioned. Even in those periods, it's the explanation for it which is where they dispute, and that's what I'm suggesting here. Different ways people have tried to explain the empty tomb. We need to know why it's empty. How did it become empty? And that's why the revelation, the explanation from God, is so critical. We need to know why it's empty. And so look at what the angel says in verse 6. "Don't be alarmed," he said. "You're looking for Jesus, the Nazarene, who was crucified. He has risen. He's not here. See the place where they laid him. But go, tell the disciples and Peter, he's going ahead of you into Galilee. There you will see him just as he told you." Now, I want to get towards thinking about what does the resurrection actually mean, but it's helpful to actually say what the resurrection is not. It's important to say the resurrection is not what we mean by why some Eastern religions talk about reincarnation. You see, reincarnation is that idea that you may have this eternal soul, but actually through various lifetimes, it finds itself in different bodies. It might be a human body, but after that, it might find its way into a cockroach or some other animal, depending on how you've lived. Now, there's some variation in the religions on that fact, but that's not resurrection. That's not what the Bible means by resurrection. You see, when the Bible speaks about resurrection, it's about the redemption of these bodies. Yes, Paul will say in 1 Corinthians 15 about having new bodies of a kind of a different glory, but it's a body which is fit for the new age. It's there is still continuity, even as there is discontinuity with the body of this age. The age to come, the Bible describes as physical. It's not non-physical. And so that's the second thing that it's not. It's not this idea of the immortality of the soul, where somehow when we die, we cast off this body and we just become these disembodied spirits that just kind of float around in the ether. That sort of teaching lends itself, that has its origin more in Greek philosophy, where the idea of this world and the material world here is dirty, it's evil. And so the aspiration then is to actually cast off this world, that the next world is better because this world is evil. That's what you find in Greek philosophy. But the Bible doesn't describe this world. It is under the curse of sin, but the body isn't to be cast off because there's something inherently bad about the physical world. No, the Bible describes this creation as good. God has created a good world, and actually through the gospel, creation groans with longing for the people of God to be redeemed, but it casts a vision towards the new creation. It's not a disembodied creation. So even in the new creation, there's a physicality to it, not a disembodiedness. Perhaps the third thing that the resurrection is not, and sadly this is something that you might find more common among people who call themselves Christian, and even some churches, is that they describe resurrection not in terms of a physical coming to life again, but actually a remembering of the life of Jesus. So the thought goes like this. The people who hold to this teaching will acknowledge that for the disciples, they did experience something really profound. Those few years that they spent with Jesus, he had a huge impact on them, changed their life. But he was unfortunately killed. And in due course, they found themselves going back to their former lives, fishing up on the Sea of Galilee, for instance. And what happens in the course of their life, they go, hey, this reminds me, do you remember that time when Jesus broke bread? Oh, wasn't that great? And it's the memory of Jesus, the idea of Jesus, perhaps some of his teachings, it inspired them to see the world differently. And so in this sense, they see the resurrection not as Jesus actually coming to life again, signalling the new creation, but actually a coming to mind, reliving the memory of Jesus. In other words, Jesus didn't rise bodily. It was just the memory of him which inspired the disciples to live differently. But you see, the New Testament speaks of resurrection with the same physicality, the same historical description as it does the crucifixion. And you can see that in the way the angel speaks, right? It's the one who was crucified who has risen. And I think that explains also why in Luke 24, when Jesus appears to his disciples, he says, well, give us something to eat. Feel, touch. I'm not a ghost. So the resurrection is not reincarnation, immortality of the soul, or it's not a metaphorical idea either. How does the Bible speak about resurrection? I've got three headings in your hand. I want to focus on the first one today. I want to focus on judgment. Right, now, the Bible speaks about resurrection as judgment in a number of places. In the Old Testament, it's there. It is there in Daniel 12 and Ezekiel 37. But as we come into the New Testament, it's still there and it becomes clearer for us. So there's a couple of passages I want to show you. The first is here in John chapter 5. Jesus says, "Very truly I tell you, a time is coming and has now come when the dead will hear the voice of the Son of God, and those who hear will live. For as the Father has life in himself, so he has granted the Son also to have life in himself, and he has given him authority to judge, because he is the Son of Man, Do not be amazed at this. For a time is coming when all who are in their graves will hear his voice and come out. Those who have done what is good will rise to life, to rise to live, and those who have done what is evil will rise to condemned. It's that last bit there which is really important to see, because often we think about resurrection as, oh, this is something which Christians will experience and look forward to, and not give much thought to what happens to those who don't trust in Jesus. But it's clear that the Bible speaks about the resurrection as signalling the time of judgment for everyone. And there will be a sorting, there will be a judgment that goes on by God. You see, the resurrection is when God raises everyone to judgment. And Daniel 12 says that as well. Look in John chapter 11. This is when Martha is lamenting that Jesus didn't quite get there in time to save her brother Lazarus from dying. "Lord," Martha said to Jesus, "if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But I know that even now God will give you whatever you ask." Jesus said to her, "Your brother will rise again." Martha answered, "I know he will rise again in the resurrection at the last day." Jesus said to her, "I am the resurrection and the life. The one who believes in me will live, even though they die. And whoever lives by believing in me will never die. Do you believe this?" "Yes, Lord," she replied. "I believe that you are the Messiah, the Son of God, who is to come into this world." You can see actually in Martha's words, there's quite common Jewish expectation that the resurrection, yes, it's when God raises everyone, but that's something that happens in the future. That's what happens on the last day. Jesus says, "Your brother will rise." She says, "Yeah, yeah, that'll happen in the end." But doesn't kind of shape how I think now. But Jesus says, "No, look, I am the resurrection. This thing that you're ascribing to the last day is actually come in me." And I think he shows that. He gives you a taste, a